Good morning. I call the Human Services, Finance and Policy Committee to order. Members, we have a quorum present. And Representative Ganda, I think you were here first. Did you have a chance to look at the minutes?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I did. I'd like to move the minutes, if I could, please.
Representative Ganda moves the approval of the April 8, 2026 minutes. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The minutes for April 8, 2026 are now approved. With that, members, we have got a couple of bills. The first bill is House File 1767. Representative Coran, welcome to your own committee. Please introduce the bill, move the bill, introduce it, and proceed.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Chair and committee members. First, I'll say we will have a DE amendment for this bill, and I'll just briefly I'll say that initially House File 1767 was written to codify ICS services. And since we've had this conversation about how to increase program integrity and where we're finding weaknesses that allow people to commit fraud within our human services systems, we've taken to heart, taken it seriously that rather than codifying a program that's so vulnerable to fraud, that perhaps we should take a different direction. And so with that, I would like to offer the DE4.
We have DE4. Representative Farron moves adoption of DE4. Any discussions? Hearing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The DE4 is now adopted. To your bill as amended.
Thank you again so much, Chair and committee members. So now with the DE4, the different direction that we've gone in is to recognize that there are some...
Representative Coran, I think the initial motion was to move the bill. I think we stated it, but I'm going to repeat it again.
Oh, okay, sure.
So the first, Representative Coran moves the House File 1767, and that was the initial motion, and then the secondary motion was to adopt the DE bill.
So we should adopt.
Do we need to adopt again? Because we already moved it at the beginning. So I'll check in with nonpartisan staff, just in case, to make sure that everything is aligned. Ms. Punier.
Mr. Chair, I think everything is okay.
All right. Proceed. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Chair. So the DE4 represents our efforts to recognize that the ICS program is vulnerable to fraud. It's been labeled as one of the 14 high-risk programs by DHS. And so rather than leave it vulnerable as it is, leaving it vulnerable to fraud, also though leaving it vulnerable where good providers who are providing much needed and necessary services are getting tangled up in prepayment or payment withholds, prepayment review, and we've seen that that action can have dire consequences on people receiving services. And so what this bill now does is establishes a legislative group, essentially that would be like a special committee, but just smaller. Thank you, Representative Keeler, for this fantastic idea. We would take basically a smaller human services committee that is still open with all stakeholders invited, and we would just get to work focused solely on what ICS could and should look like so that it's not vulnerable to fraud and it's meeting the needs of people in our communities and that it's workable for the people who are supporting our neighbors. So it establishes that legislative group. It does have an aggressive timeline because I'd love it if we could have done some of this work sooner, and that's why you're seeing we're serious about making this change quickly. Part of the bill also entails that during this period, the Department of Human Services should pause any changes. It'll allow the work group to create that transition plan, to create a vision of what those programs can look like that are solid and not vulnerable to fraud, where people can still get the services they need. And in order to be able to do that effectively, we need to be able to work with a pause in all the changes that have happened. But we're only asking for about 6 months or so for that, for DHS to kind of pause. The bill also does state, though, that during this time when we're reconfiguring ICS supports together, that DHS, by all means, can and should continue to investigate fraud and hold people accountable. So it does nothing to stop those efforts. And finally, Section 3 of the bill, it terminates ICS as we know it today. And I know that can sound scary when we're talking about terminating a program. However, it was pretty scary when the Department of Human Services terminated a program without this extensive group work together. And so this is a collective effort between legislators and community members to recognize that we have a problem and sort of put a sunset on our own terms and recognize that the way things are going now aren't quite working out, and we're all ready to find a solution that works better, and we're ready to say that the way it's working now isn't feasible in the long term. So that's the meat of the bill, and I'll turn it over to our testifier.
Mr. Berg, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and thank you for the opportunity to testify in full support of this bill. I want to begin by acknowledging something that is both obvious and uncomfortable. Ending or even seriously contemplating ending a service that took years to design and roll out and that has only been operating statewide for just over 5 years should give us all pause. It should feel heavy, it should make us uneasy, and it should force us to slow down and ask hard questions. At the same time, it would be dishonest to sit here and pretend that integrated community supports, as currently implemented, is working the way anyone intended. It isn't. People receiving services feel the instability, providers trying to do everything right feel it every day, and the system itself has shown real strain. As we have this conversation, it's also important to ground it in facts, especially about what ICS actually is and how we got here. ICS was not an accidental service or a workaround. It was explicitly created as a new service in Minnesota's home and community-based statewide transition plan that was approved by CMS in 2019. DHS described ICS as the replacement for customized living for individuals ages 18 to 54 on CADI and BI waivers. The system was directed intentionally towards this model. And when we talk about ICS growth, we need to be precise. The growth of ICS is often described as exponential and lumped in with other high-risk services that have been called out over the past several months. But DHS's own waiver plan amendments tell a different story. DHS acknowledged that ICS growth was slower than anticipated. And importantly, much of the so-called growth was not new people entering services. It was shifting individuals from customized living and supportive living settings into the ICS service DHS itself created. The context matters because mischaracterizing growth leads to policy overcorrections, and those overcorrections land hardest on the people receiving services and providers acting in good faith. Which brings me to a critical point. Nothing in this bill limits DHS's authority to address fraud, enhance program integrity, or remove bad actors from the system. In fact, this bill explicitly preserves DHS's ability to do enforcement, investigations, and sanctions. So let me be very clear. This is not a bill that weakens oversight. It is a bill that insists on smarter oversight. Right now, DHS is attempting to fix structural problems mid-flight, through rapid changes, shifting standards, and proposals that fundamentally alter the service without a replacement ready. That approach risks destabilizing everyone, including the good providers, while still failing to resolve the underlying integrity issues. This bill does something far more responsible. It creates the space to intentionally rebuild so that the program integrity is not retrofitted onto a fragile system, but embedded directly into the system on the next service. Better rate structures, clearer documentation standards, stronger guardrails around high-cost plans, defined licensing expectations, and consistent enforcement tools that are clear from day one. That is how you create a system that is tighter, stronger, and more enforceable from the start, rather than constantly chasing the problems after the fact. Right now, the people with the most at stake are individuals who rely on integrated community supports for continuity, daily relation-based supports that help them stay housed, stable, and connected to their communities. Right alongside them are providers who built programs, hired staff, and invested in good faith based on the direction DHS gave us. These are not bad actors. These are not providers gaming the system. They are organizations trying to follow the rules in a system where rules kept moving. Over the past 5 years, expectations around rates, documentation, service structure, licensing, and compliance have shifted repeatedly, often without clear codification or realistic timelines. Providers adapt, they reinvest, they recalibrate, and then the rules change again. That is not accountability, that is churn. And churn is devastating to continuity of care. Now we are facing proposals like converting a daily relationship-based service into a unit-based model. Without data, without evidence it will improve outcomes, and without a clear explanation of how it will avoid fragmenting care. For people receiving services, these are not abstract policy decisions. They mean staff turnover, disrupted routines, gaps in care, and for some individuals, the real risk of losing housing altogether. That is why this bill matters. The language before you creates a deliberate pause, one that preserves enforcement authority while preventing irreversible structural decisions until a replacement is ready. It forces DHS, legislators, providers, counties, advocates, and people with lived experience to confront the hard questions that have gone unanswered for years. What does sustainability actually look like? What does real program integrity look like when built correctly? And how do we protect continuity of care while holding the system accountable? Without this bill, the most likely outcome is not a better system. It's provider exits, frozen capacity, and people losing supports long before a new service exists. This bill slows the dangerous part without stopping progress. It protects people now, and it sets us up to rebuild a system that is stronger, clearer, and more enforceable from day one. Mr. Chair and members, this is not about defending a flawed service. It is about protecting people while we build something better and build it the right way. I encourage you to support this bill and help see this across the finish line. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Do we have anyone? Oh, no, we don't have the second person. Zania Harut, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just want to make sure you guys can hear me.
Yes,
okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the opportunity to testify. My name is Zania Harut, and I'm the board chair of the Residential Providers Association of Minnesota, and I'm also an ICS provider. I want to thank I want to thank Representative Curran and Chair Nora for their continued work on this issue and their commitment to getting ICS right for the people who depend on it. We've spent the past several months across multiple stakeholder meetings documenting the structural problems in this program and bringing forward solutions. We appreciate DHS's willingness to meet with us throughout the process, and we look forward to continuing work with the department and stakeholders on policy clarifications in the meantime. We support this amendment as the right alternative to the governor's proposal to convert ICS to unit-based billing and the other proposals to ICS. We've had productive conversations with the department about that, and what we heard is that what we heard from the community, as well as that the unit-based model raises serious operational questions, particularly for settings where staffing reflects availability and presence rather than discrete tasks. Our view is that how this program is set up right now, it cannot be resolved responsibly, and that the current problems in ICS are based in the fact that there are two separate models operating. There is a site-based model in which staff are stationed in buildings with multiple individuals, and in ICS there's also a scattered site model in which individuals are living in scattered site apartments and the staff are coming to them for on-call support or for scheduled meetings. And both of those types of services are currently operating under the same rate framework as if they were identical. And that mismatch is creating a serious compliance risk across the entire system. Because ICS has never been fully codified in statute, there is no answer to resolve these issues with billing and compliance. Enforcement defaults to whatever interpretation in policy, as Josh mentioned, the policy keeps changing, to which interpretation is the most restrictive at the time, regardless of what the providers were actually following in DHS's language online or in the FAQs. Beyond billing and documentation issues, ICS providers have documented several structural gaps that must be addressed with this group. There is no shared staffing recognition currently in statute, leaving site-based providers with staffing on-site with no legal basis for the staffing model in which they operate. There's no standardized setting approval process currently. There's no coverage for nursing and transportation, and most site-based programs are actually just covering this. And there's currently no reliable public data on how many settings are actually operating and how many units are occupied in those settings. And I want to close with that. All ICS providers are currently uncomfortable with the status quo. I believe that this amendment puts the legislature in the lead on deciding, designing what comes next with a clear mandate, a defined timeline, and a requirement to engage stakeholders who know the program best. Replacing ICS with a service that is clearly defined, properly structured, and built on a stable statutory foundation is what individuals we serve actually need. Thank you for listening, and I'm open for questions.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Do we now have anyone else in the room? Seeing none, member discussions, Representative Barker.
Thank you, Chair. First question I have, I know this is down the road, but we're looking at the broader picture. How do you envision and what's your understanding how this would affect counties and providers?
Representative Corrin.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chair Backer. As far as as far as it goes, creating a new program or finding something in place of this, it's my understanding that the funding structure itself and who's paying for which shares is not affected by any of this work that would require changes outside of this bill.
Okay, good. Thank you. And then are there plans, are you thinking about then, because we're working on making improvements, are we thinking then including reports and audits during that, as some of the recommendations to deliver these services better to folks at home and in their apartments? Are we looking at, you know, not just reports and audits, but are there going to be some teeth behind it, enforcement?
Representative Corrin.
Yeah, I can address that briefly, and then I can also turn it over to our testifier for additional details if he'd like to share some. But what some of the work that's been done prior to today in the background was Mr. Berg and DHS and a collection of people receiving services and providing services have been trying to work on a replacement plan. We were hoping to at some point come to committee with that replacement plan, but what we're finding out is that as folks continue to do this work and try to dig in and figure out how it can be appropriately audited along the way and what kind of reports that we might be able to do, not just at the end of a year, but during a year to confirm and back up the claims that are being billed, that this requires more time than the legislature offers in this moment. And so that's why we decided, you know what, we just actually need a group specifically assigned to do this work and not necessarily under the time constraints that the active legislative session has. And I can turn it over to Mr. Berg for additional.
Mr. Berg, any addition?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Backer. The thing that I would add is I think this gives the time to understand where the department thinks it needs additional authority or oversight capabilities. I would argue that under 245D, 256, to several locations within statute, they have the authority to properly oversee and audit and request data, request information, service documentation. They do it all the time in other 245D programs, including this one as well. So it will give the opportunity, is there an area that needs to be strengthened or just reiterated or codified differently so that then it is clear that the department is able to oversee whatever that new program is that they may think that there's weaknesses in their ability to do so right now. So I think those are all great recommendations and things that could come out of a group like this if that's what their priorities were.
Representative Barker.
No more questions. Thank you, Chair. Thank you.
Vice Chair Kiel.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Curran, for the bill. So I guess the bill is establishing a legislative study group. And I just want to talk a little bit about why I think that is a good approach. I know that we chatted about it. Representative Bakeberg and I did this around attendance. So if anybody knows from the education lane, there's all these opportunities that we can come together and brainstorm about a solution. There's task forces, there's working groups, there's like all of these things. And sometimes when we create task forces, what happens is you get like 1 million people on a task force and they're just hunkering down on their part of the work. But also you end up naming specific people, and that means that only those people are able to come into the room and have conversations. We don't always love that because we don't know where and who is impacted by certain situations. And so the reason why Representative Bakeberg and I really looked into what a legislative study group is because we believed it was the most bipartisan way to find a solution that put the legislators in charge of having those conversations. It opens it up to anybody in the public. Anybody who does this work is welcome to join. It's public. There's hearings about it, so you can go back and see. And you then come out of this with strong recommendations to take into the next year that bipartisan legislators have gotten behind. So you're part of the solution. And I think we've been able to see slow but really good work together. And so I support this approach. I think it's a good way to talk about a complex situation collectively, not only us across the aisle, but then across the aisle in the other chamber too, because sometimes we know what we do in the House doesn't always match what the Senate wants to do. So I appreciate it. Thank you for thinking a little bit collectively. It's also a good financial move because it's not as expensive as some of the other opportunities we have. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Vice Chair Kill. I'm hearing that it's not going to cost us $300,000 to get a study going, so thank you. As long as we can get volunteers in, I will go to Vice Chair Gilman.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you so much for the presentation today. So I have a couple questions. I don't know if DHS is here or not. If they're here, they're not here. Okay. So I can get this information from them, but is the ICS service, is there like a budget item or is this going to help us because we'll be able to have this, not working group, but what is it called, the legislative working group? So we can, I just want to know, like, budget-wise, is this to help us when we talk about, I was intrigued by the scattered services versus just, one residence or one space. So is this going to end up, like, are we going to see numbers as well around this? Because for us, you know, just with our budget growing, and again, just wanting to protect and ensure there's not waste, fraud, and abuse happening with scattered services, and we've seen some of these things come out on the news where people were not actually receiving services, and that, you know, sends alarm, and there's a lot of shock factor. And there's also truth to some of the things that we're seeing. And we're seeing some providers that have figured out ways to exploit the system. So I just want to know, like, are we, I just want to know some numbers. And then also just with these two different approaches, are we going to, a little bit more about that.
Representative Cora.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you. I can take a shot at that without DHS in the room. And I'm sure Mr. Berg has some insight to offer as well. I will say that the numbers and data that you're talking about, those are still ongoing efforts, right? Like, DHS is still doing investigations into questionable claims, into allegations of fraud. All of that is still happening. As part of this legislative study group, I would imagine that we would be looking at those numbers. The group wouldn't be themselves collecting those numbers. That wouldn't be the goal of this particular group. But I would expect that we would look at some statistics and look at where the bulk of the problems lie so that we can focus our efforts to lock those down and stop those problems from happening. Because what we know as ICS exists today is that there are some providers in some environments where this is working really well and people are getting what they need. But there are environments where this is not working. There are people who aren't providing the service, like you mentioned. Mm-hmm. And that's why we have to take such a deep dive when we've got a program that's sort of described as this blanket program, and then on the ground it's delivered or not very differently depending on where it is. So I hope that answers a little bit of your question. I don't know if you had a little bit to add.
Mr. Burke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Gilman. I mean, I think this would be perfect information that this work group would request and seek to have data on the case mix information of individuals receiving ICS services, which the department already has, and just that information from that starts to tell a story of why we have two different models of the 24/7 staffing versus those that don't have staff on site 24/7 that are doing more of the IHS-like model. So being able to get that data that the department is currently collecting, they currently have through the Men Choices Assessment and everything else, the claims and all that stuff will start to tell a story. So I think it's a perfect piece of information that I think many of us have been asking for in trying to get our hands on to help tell the story of why we are here where we are, that we just can't always get that information as easily or transparently as we kind of hope. So.
Thank you. So just one quick follow-up with that. So the folks that are in the gray are intentionally defrauding and stealing taxpayer dollars by saying that they're providing a service right now. Would this bill, you know, make it so DHS could not pause or suspend if there's known things happening in this timeline? Would that actually happen, or could it? Because when I read it, it sounds like they could not stop that piece.
Representative Corrine.
Thank you, Chair. I appreciate that question, Vice Chair Gilman. And it was it was very intentional that we made sure the language allowed for those investigations to continue. So if there are some weaknesses in that language that needs to be tightened up, I'm very, very open to ensuring that those processes can continue, and that when there are credible allegations of fraud, where we're seeing very clear evidence that services have been part of any kind of fraud, waste, or abuse, that can be addressed in the moment, and that we're not stopping those efforts. So happy to work on that with you in the background. I know we're going to be laying bills over to continue work on, but that is an integral piece of this bill that has to stay in place. Otherwise, this would not be, it would sort of be for naught, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Just wanted to verify, is that the 3.7 to 3.9?
Yes. Yes.
Mr. Burke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. I just want to take this as a quick opportunity to say the department already has the authority to do everything that you just said. Nothing will change until a replacement service comes into place. The department has the authority to request service documentation from any of us providers, and they do it on a regular basis. So just for example, they ask us, hey, Representative Gilman receives ICF services in your setting. Can you give us the last 3 months of the data related to, or service documentation, so that they can then match it up with the claims that have been submitted? So if there's a misunderstanding of what authority DHS already has, maybe that's a question for the department, because they already are able to audit us on a regular basis whenever they want to make sure that the claims we submit are matching the service documentation and everything that we have that is required under 245D already. So this bill doesn't change any of that, doesn't take away any authority, doesn't grant any additional authority. They already have the authority to do that. Now it's just whether or not they are. That's a separate question.
Vice Chair Gilman.
Yeah, thank you so much for that. I appreciate it.
Just a quick question. Do we still have the moratorium that was instituted for ICS?
Yes, Mr. Chair, as far as I understand, the moratorium is still in place. Now, there was supposed to be a moratorium exception process that was outlined and published as of January 1. That still has yet to come out from the department. I know they are working on something related to ICS specifically, and was told recently that it'll be in the next couple weeks, but we've been told it's going to be in the next couple weeks for the past couple months. So I'm not sure where that is at.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a simple question, Representative Curran. You know, Representative Heuer mentioned that others could join, but this is limited to the eight elected and appointed as the only voting members of the task force.
Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Murphy. So that's correct. However, I would note that it would operate just like this type of committee operates. So the advantage to that is it's fully public. We would bring in folks like Mr. Berg and hopefully have a chance to meet more folks receiving the services to talk about what's working and what's not working, so that whoever lands on that team can hear that public input on the record, and the legislative intent behind all of that is all laid out, as Representative Keeler mentioned. What we see in a community-based task force where there are named groups, of course, some groups get left out. Not everybody's in the know all the time. Somebody might find out 2 weeks later that this group is happening and they have so much to offer and they have such good insight, but they didn't know about it until now, so they're not part of the conversation, right? This allows, as things are going on, that anybody with an opinion on how this should go or insight on how these programs are vulnerable is more than welcome, and we hope that they would come to offer that insight.
Will the elected chair be the lead of that committee like we have here? Will they have any ability to kind of direct how that meeting is going in terms of who testifies, that sort of thing? Or is that going to rotate between Republican and Democrat sides? How will that work in an 8-8?
Representative Correa.
Thank you, Chair, and I appreciate that question, too. This is something I've been thinking about because we're in a unique tie, right? The way that I understand it now is that it would probably fall under the purview of that committee, and we would look at what our current power-sharing agreement dictates, and I would hope that we would sort of do a spinoff of that. And just really have this sort of nonpartisan group of legislators. If the group decided it was best to rotate chairs, sure, maybe we could do that. But I really don't see this as a standard sort of committee setting where you have a chair who's driving an agenda. There's really only one agenda, and everybody's part of that team. So however that structure rolls out is really not that important to me. It's really about just getting folks in the room who are dedicated to the work and dedicated to listening truly to anybody who shows up. And to your point about not allowing testifiers, I would hope that any legislator part of that group would be against that practice.
Vice Chair Kayla's got input on that.
Just to clarify, feel like, so even when we weren't in a tie, when the Democrats were in charge and Bakeberg and I did this, it was a co-chair working group. I mean, the whole point of this is design, but that's what the legislators at that table decide together. That's why when we went into it in a very bipartisan fashion, knowing that that's how you make good work stick. So all the questions you guys are asking are really great questions to have in that space. And collectively, what we were able to do is sort of decide what the topic of conversation wanted to be. And then we just did a call out. There's a whole staff that comes with this from a different agency that helps do public call outs. And it's part like organizations and entities share that with other networks. And so it's like this in the sense that public can have an input, but it's not like this in the sense that it shouldn't feel partisan. And so that's, again, back to just, I've not seen a lot of other people do this, but just from how we did this last 2 years ago, we went into it very much thinking co-chairs.
Representative Murphy.
Chair, I appreciate that, and that's the way I'd like to see it go, too. It's just in preparation for it. It's always good to make sure you don't look back on it, at the end of it and say, well, that could have been done a little better. So just in preparation, maybe the co-chair is just an idea that it keeps it the same way as it's been here. So thank you.
It's a good point so that we can even add it too. Mr. Beck, did you have any quick comments?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy, the one thing, and to Representative Keeler's points, I love this approach. So then this group is not led by the department, which, we're in the position we're in because a lot of these decisions have been led by the department. So it takes this and puts it in the legislature's control. And it's also not led by stakeholders and providers or whatever so that you get a biased approach to it. So this will hopefully bring, just a more objective, thoughtful, comprehensive approach, bring all the stakeholders together. And then when we come back or when this group comes back with recommendations, there's not going to be those feelings of it was driven by one agenda-driving group. So,
to your closing remark, Representative Correa.
Thank you so much, Chair, and thank you, members, for the discussion. I hope that the committee finds this to be a suitable alternative for the current governor proposal. We know that putting all ICS services into a 15-minute unit just isn't feasible. But we also know that there's a lot of problems with the structure of the program as it is today. So this is a genuine effort to bring us all together to fix a problem as we see it, rather than sort of wait and see what happens to it, and sort of giving that control not just to us as legislators, but giving it really to anyone in the community who has input so we can get this right.
With that, Representative Curran renews the motion, House File 1767, as amended to be laid over. So the bill is laid over. The next bill is House File 2068. Vice Chair Keeler, I know there's an amendment that we adopted last year, which is in your packet. So we will review the bill as it was amended because there's no engrossment. Please introduce your bill and proceed. I'll move the motion that House File 2068, as was previously amended, to be moved by Vice Chair Keeler.
Thank you, Chair and members. Addressing youth homelessness is something that I came into this work really passionate to do. A lot of the work that I have done has been not only around ending homelessness, but also addressing attendance in school. What we've seen and what we've heard over and over that youth homelessness is having an impact across many spectrums. When we talk about attendance, one of the number one reasons why our kids aren't successful in school is they don't have access to housing. When I started this work 6 years ago, we had a committee that was the Preventing Homelessness Committee. I want to thank then Speaker Melissa Hortman, who saw the importance of us having intentional conversations around homelessness. Because the truth is, homelessness isn't just something that our committee should be talking about. Homelessness impacts every committee in every way. We have an interagency council on homelessness that continues to prove the tentacles that we need to approach. I want to talk about veterans homelessness for a minute, because we talk about how proud we are of the fact that we're getting to a point that we're ending veterans homelessness. But the truth is, the reason why we have been able to do that is we have made consistent ongoing investments. Even when we're seeing progress, we don't let up the gas. And what I want to say is, with the Homeless Youth Act, we have made massive investments. I understand that, and we have seen amazing things happen from border to border in Minnesota. Some of the approaches we've been able to take have been making sure that we have a greater Minnesota voice at this table, because I know a lot of us serve outside of the metro, and we often hear and only see the stories that are within proximity to the Capitol. And so it's important to me that in this time we not only talk about the cities, but we talk about border to border and what's happening in rural Minnesota, because the truth is, homelessness for our kids is happening in every corner of this state. We know that there's always funding shortages here. And the thing that I think we hear often is how much we believe that our youth should have an opportunity to become successful Minnesotans. Dr. Foldis at the U did a study, I think it was almost 10 years ago now. If you're interested in nerding out on the return of investment in homelessness, look at Dr. Foldis and his study. He says, and we know that preventative care works, when we invest in ending homelessness and supporting our youth particularly, there is a taxpayer return on investment when we do this. We know that we're serving over 15,000 youth with outreach. We're serving over 8,000 youth in drop-in centers. We have almost 1,000 youth in emergency shelters, and we have over 1,000 youth using housing programs. This is in all of our communities. This is happening everywhere. We know that every single space is having to turn away youth on a daily basis. It is our job as the adults in the room to care about the kids. I have amazing testifiers with me. Please feel free to ask questions. One thing that I've taken a lot of pride in is doing this work along stakeholders. We have many of them in the room. I want to give a special shout out to the Wilder Foundation. They have been a critical partner in making sure that we have up-to-date data and we know what's happening here. They just recently came out with the assessment of needs for the pregnant and parenting youth experiencing homelessness. It's heartbreaking. I was reading it this morning and actually crying. It's hard data to hear, but thank you for the consistent work to give us the data that we know has to be taken into consideration. With that, Mr. Chair, I'll move to our testifiers.
Thank you so much. We have Mr. Lewis. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Noor and members of the committee. My name is James Lewis. I currently serve as Chief Program Officer for The Link. The Link is a youth and adult-led nonprofit based in North Minneapolis that provides street outreach, drop-in center, shelter and housing, along with other services for youth and young families experiencing homelessness, sex trafficking, or who are involved in the juvenile non-justice system, as we call it. I'm also here today representing the Youth Service Network, which is a statewide collaborative of homeless youth services serving agencies across the state. I'm also here today to testify in strong support of House File 2068, which would provide much needed additional funding for our Minnesota Homeless Youth Act. We are all incredibly grateful for the investments that have already been made into the Homeless Youth Act, and it has made a huge difference. We've been able to expand services, shelter, and housing for youth and young families across the state. There are now a total of 47 grantees across the state of Minnesota. When I first started over 20 years ago, there was less than 20. We've had 23,640 youth served within street outreach and drop-in center programs, 791 in emergency shelter, and 1,086 between July 23 and June 30th of 24. This is absolutely amazing progress and work being done. We know it works from what young people are saying, along with the outcomes that we see. 94% of youth who exited one of our homeless youth programs did not experience housing instability within 6 months after the program, which is a huge success for us. I could give countless examples, but this young lady here is a great example of what possibilities can happen from support through the Homeless Youth Act. She is an energetic young leader and just starting on her journey of making a big impact in our community, and we are very lucky to have her with us at the link. With these investments, we've been able to make great progress, but right now we're still under the threat from cuts from our federal government, which could force the link and our partners within the YSN to close down shelter and housing programs if we're not able to find other funding sources to fill the federal gap. We are facing, as a youth service network, a total of $8.5 million annually in cuts. In addition to this, to any prior cuts taking place, we still wanted to advocate for increased resources to continue work on reducing the numbers of youth experiencing homelessness. Just one demonstration of the need, in the last biennium, DHS received $100.75 million in requests for HYA funding and was able to award only $40.9 million. This funding is critically needed to support our amazing youth, and we appreciate you hearing us today and all the support that you have to help these youth strive. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony to Ms. Brown. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair, and the rest of the committee. My name is Shari Brown, and I work with The Link. I just want to thank you all for being here today and supporting the Homeless Youth Act. I want to share a little about myself today with the focus on how I'm doing now, which is truly amazing. As a child and growing up, my family was dealing with a lot of generational poverty and trauma. In result of that, I ended up moving around a lot, staying with friends for a while. You can call it couch hopping. Then at the age of 18, I had been living with my mom, but due to the rules and her subsidized housing, I could no longer stay there anymore. So I ended up having to move out, and I had to end up experiencing homelessness. It wasn't easy, but I got through it with my own skills, strength, and some help from The Link. I went to The Link's core drop-in center in Apple Valley, and from there, they helped me with a lot of supportive services, especially getting into supportive housing. Having stable housing meant that I could work on my goals and dreams that I have for myself. I am a natural leader and a caregiver, some of the strengths that The Link saw in me too. So they hired me as a member on their youth housing committee, where I was able to oversee all of the housing programs and shelters that we provide for the youth that are going through the same things that I did. They also hired me as their front desk receptionist, and I was recently promoted to be a full-time street outreach worker. But that's not it at all. I was able to save up and purchase a home and start college. As a front desk receptionist and a street outreach worker, I work with youth every day who are in deep crisis and have nowhere to go. Even once, unfortunately, I have to navigate to other resources because we may not have the needs or the funding to do such. I was just helping a 14-year-old staying in someone's backyard that had nowhere to go. 14. All the youth although I love helping youth, it is super hard to see that so many young people are out here experiencing homelessness. I've worked through a lot, and I am proud of where I am at and where I am going. And supportive housing has helped me. And I know you all have a lot of decisions to make, but deciding to spend money on supporting youth and supportive housing shouldn't be a hard one. Having a safe and stable place to live is life-changing and also can be life-saving. And right now, housing cuts from the federal government are threatening to shut down many of the housing programs for youth and young adults. And we need your support at a state level to step in and give us funding for the Homeless Youth Act. Thank you and have a great day.
Thank you so much, Ms. Brown, and thank you so much for sharing your story with us. I appreciate you being here. And we do have another testifier, Ms. Sadowski. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Good morning, everybody. Can you hear me? Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Okay, great. Thank you. Yep, good morning, and thank you for the opportunity to testify this morning. I'm Amber Sadowski, the Executive Director of Lifehouse up in Duluth, and we're also a member of the Youth Services Network. Each year, we serve 800 youth a year, and these youth are facing a lack of caregiver support, and 80% of these youth have experienced homelessness. We have been fortunate to receive funding from the Homeless Youth Act since 2013, and these funds have allowed us to provide stability and support to thousands of young people. We have 50 units of housing, a comprehensive mental health and substance use program, a drop-in youth center, and education and employment services. HIA funds are particularly impactful for Greater Minnesota because of the unique realities and challenges that we face in our area. In northeastern Minnesota, we face a poverty rate of almost 13%, which is well above the state average of 9.3%. Resources are more scarce in rural areas, making Lifehouse a vital hub for youth across the northeast region. Transportation is also a hurdle. In many Duluth neighborhoods, buses only run once per hour, and in small towns and rural Greater Minnesota counties, homeless youth are often isolated, unable to obtain mental health, substance use, or educational support, thereby negatively impacting their educational and economic trajectories. HIA funds support programs that address these issues across Greater Minnesota. I'm here to advocate for an increase in HIA funding. Rising costs are stretching resources thin, while the needs are still very high. In tight financial times for our state and our programs, like a previous testimony stated, investing in homeless youth services is a no-brainer. Data shows there's a huge return on investment when we put money into supportive services for homeless youth. Funding homeless youth services reduces reliance on costly public systems while increasing employment and long-term economic stability. For 35 years, we've proven that with the right support, homeless youth don't just survive, they lead. And today, our alumni, our current Lifehouse board members, business owners, social workers, just to name a few. And we're really grateful for your support of HIA funding, which really transforms lives and strengthens our entire statewide community. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Do we have anyone else in the public who wanted to testify on this bill? Seeing none, Chair Fisher. We'll go to member discussion.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Noor. Thank you, Representative Keeler, for bringing this forward and for all the work you've done in this area since you've come to the legislature. You've really helped raise up the voices that need to be raised up and advocate for those that, when they're provided with those proper resources, become wildly successful. Thank you to Ms. Brown for your testimony. You did a wonderful job and are a perfect example of what happens when we provide the services for the youth. They get very engaged in not only having fulfilling lives, but also giving back to the community, doing the work back in this area. I used to work in the homeless youth world for 17 years. I started in 2007. Back at that point in time, the funding from the state was only $100,000 a year. Mm-hmm. I can tell you that with the additional investments that we've made, whenever the state made additional investments, we always saw additional investments come in from different foundations, from different people across, so that the money that you see here is not just the $89 million. There are additional resources that come in from other people, because when they saw the state making the investments, I saw that so often when the state made investments in this area, others came forward too. And so the nonprofits were able to leverage that with additional dollars and be able to provide the services out there. Years ago when I first started, we didn't have the capability of always having the staff on to provide mental health services in-house. We didn't have the capability of always being able to provide the case management, help make sure that people had the career resources support, the education support, the wraparound services so they become successful. As these dollars were added over the years, I could see the outcomes increase greatly for the success and stable housing for our youth as they went forward. And that's why it is so important for us to continue these efforts. And more importantly, is it's an investment in our youth. And what has been the most satisfying thing that I ever had in this job when I had it was seeing the youth like Ms. Brown, who were, you know, on the street struggling, getting the support, and once they got the support, they were wildly successful and invested back in the community. So often I've seen people that used to be in our field who were homeless as social workers out there, as doctors, as nurses. This is what happens when we give our youth resources they need to be successful. I say this is a worthwhile investment, and thank you for bringing this forward.
Thank you, Representative Fischer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Keeler, you talked about how this is a border-to-border issue. We had the virtual testifier to kind of highlight some of the needs up in Greater Minnesota too, but I was wondering if you could outline some of the services that are actively being provided and needed in Greater Minnesota as well, because we know there are needs in literally every single county across the state. So I was just wondering if you could expand on some of what is currently happening in Greater Minnesota too.
Vice Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the question. I love the opportunity to talk about Greater Minnesota. We have another testifier that can join us to answer, I think, more specifically about some of the numbers and services. Chair.
Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Noren, members of the committee. My name is Alexis Oberdorfer. I'm the Senior Vice President of Services for Lutheran Social Service of Minnesota. We serve at Lutheran Social Service approximately 3,000 youth every year through continuum of services. So from street outreach, youth resource centers, emergency shelters, transitional housing, independent living skills, and one-to-one assistance. We do this across eight locations throughout Minnesota, going from Duluth, Virginia, Brainerd, St. Cloud, Wilmer, Mankato, Rochester's, and the Twin Cities Metro. So you will see those services. I'll give you some examples of that. If we take a look at the Brainerd area, we serve 64 youth with housing, 65 youth through our street outreach program in that area and the surrounding counties. Mankato, we have a resource center. We provide street outreach. We provide housing and shelter services. So at the Youth Resource Center, we touched 132 youth last year. We provided about 7,236 basic needs and survival items. 22 youth were supported with housing. 24 youth were supported in shelters in the Mankato area. When we take a look at what this looks like in Rochester, our Youth Resource Center supported 75 youth. Our street outreach program provided 3,788 basic needs and survival items to youth. 15 youth were supported in housing and 12 youth were supported in shelters. If you take a look at our St. Cloud area, we served almost 2,000 youth this past year. We are seeing a lot of youth that on that cusp of their birthday, similar to the testimony that we heard earlier, are finding themselves without a place to live. They don't have the resources at the same level to, if you will, couch help and have people to stay with. They're finding themselves living in places that are just not meant for habitation.
Representative Frederick.
I just want to highlight the importance of this bill. I had the privilege of joining Lutheran Social Services with Representative Keeler in Mankato at the Reach, and to see the people there and the work that they're providing. It is one that I know my community needs, but as we've just heard too, like it's every single county across the state has needs, and the more that we can invest with this, the more people we could potentially impact as well. So I think this is greatly needed. I just want to thank Representative Keeler for bringing this bill.
Representative Hicks.
I also wanted to say thank you for this. I'm glad you mentioned the Rochester numbers, because I had an opportunity to talk to a constituent. Well, she's not a constituent anymore because you housed her in a place that's not in my district. But it is still in Rochester. And she is a young lady who I've known for many, 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 many years when she originally entered foster care. And she is now 19 and has really been struggling with her housing. And the supports that she's received through these programs have managed to help her get housed. And based on my most recent conversation, it sounds like is also helping her get some support for her substance use disorder. And so from the bottom of my heart, I just want to say thank you of how this young woman has so much potential. And I believe fully that she will maybe one day sit where you're sitting and share a similar story of giving back to her community once she has what she needs. So thank you.
Representative Mark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Keeler, how many homeless youth do you anticipate that it'll help in the state of Minnesota?
How
many people take advantage, or just that are homeless would take advantage of the program?
I guess it's kind of hard to answer the question because it's like in general, like as a whole. Can you restate the question?
Sure. Yeah, like so Lutheran Social Services said they helped, 3,000 people. And so that's one group of people. How many of them were homeless? And then like that, other organizations that are also doing the same. So how many people are we talking about? And the reason I ask it is because this is the bill that's asking for $89 million. If we're able to help someone for 6 months, even at $1,700 a month for an apartment, that means that we can help out about 8,700 kids or people a year. And so I just want to find out how many we are helping. Versus the 8,700. If we get $1,700 a month, that's $10,000 for each one for rental assistance for 6 months. So how many people are we helping for the $89 million? Because I also noticed that we changed from the last ask. We were at $14 million last session.
If somebody from the agency.
Vice Chair, do you have anyone to
speak
to? Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good morning, Chair Noor and members of the committee. My name is Lorna Schmidt. I'm the Legislative Director for the Homelessness, Housing, and Support Services Administration at DHS. Providing an exact number would be difficult. It's certainly dependent on the level of the investment, but I think also very much varies based on the types of services that are provided and the regions of the state, just recognizing different costs. So I'm not able to provide an exact number, but we could go back and again provide more information on how many youth have been served in the various program areas with the investments that have been made in the past, and I'd be happy to follow up with that.
Representative.
Mr. Chair, yeah, that would be great. I'd love to see that. You talked about return on investment too, so when we're looking at return on investment, it'd be nice to have some numbers that go along with that. I'm a business person. We look at that type of thing all the time. And so it'd be nice to say, okay, yeah, this is how we came up with the numbers. This is how we came up with the number of people we're helping. This is how we came up for the ask. And this is how we came up with the return on investment. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much. Chair Fisher.
Thank you, Chair Noren. And to Representative Murphy, is in terms of it's a little hard to come up with numbers, having been a CFO in a nonprofit serving homeless youth, it depends on the type of services you're looking at. If you're looking at just rent support, you're able to serve a lot more than if you're in shelter. Shelter is one of the most expensive parts, and that's also one of the areas that we have the greatest shortage in. And when you take a look at a shelter bed, you're taking a look at something that's usually somewhere around $20,000 for the bed for the entire year. So depending on how many youth you turn over in that time frame makes a difference. Sometimes you have some youth that stay longer, some that are shorter. So the numbers that you'll get are going to probably be an average, but there's it's all looking at the continuum, because in the Homeless Youth Act, they're supporting all sorts of services across, from shelter, which is the most expensive, all the way down to rent supports. Rent supports, depending on the type of rent and the type of program, it might be a transitional housing program that would be phased out over a 24-month period. So you might be covering most of that rent of the youth at the beginning, and by the 24th month, you're providing very little, because at that point in time, the youth has had enough support in finding a job that is able to take care of paying for the rent. So it's sometimes hard to come up with the exact numbers because of the variety of different services and how far the dollars go in each area.
Representative Gunn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just so we're clear on the numbers, I know we're seeing numbers of $14 million and $89 million. Was there a previous appropriation that we're adding $14 million to for a higher number? So what's the actual total number if we approve this as amended?
Vice Chair Kim.
So the dollar amount is, we talked about this in the budget year. The reason why we're bringing it forward is to just continue the conversation. If there's any funding that's available, we would like to have this as an option to put funding towards every community, we can have Lutheran Social Services come back up and talk about some of their specific services that they provide in different spaces. I think the agency, we expected that they would come with some more data on actually how many, you know, like people they're serving. This is why, if you remember, one of the things that the agency wanted to do was to repeal the report that was regarding the Homeless Youth Act. This is why I think keeping the report is really important, so that when they show up to answer questions, we have a report that we can reflect. So I think continuously asking the agency to provide that for us is something that we should be able to do.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I didn't get an answer to the total dollar. $14 million, $89 million. Something in between. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Cora.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Vice Chair Keeler. I just wanted to bring in, too, as part of this conversation, the kids that we're talking about, the vast majority, nearly 85% of these kids, are coming from circumstances where they either have been abused, have witnessed abuse, or some way, shape, or form really involved in substance abuse, whether that's themselves or their families. So when we talk about return on investment, I just want to make sure that we're really thinking, as Vice Chair Keeler mentioned, this touches every single committee jurisdiction. And as I'm looking at this, when we talk about substance use disorder, these upfront investments help reduce the expenses that we would have in substance use in the future. They also reduce the expenses that we might have in our public safety committee budget, having to have folks move through the criminal justice system. So I just want to make sure that those are on record as things that we also, as we're making investments here in human services, that it goes far beyond this committee throughout the trajectory of these kids' lives. Thank you.
Vice Chair Keeler, to your closing remarks.
Thanks. We know that from requests that have come in, we have at least a $60 million shortfall from people that we're turning away from services that we need. We also need to remember that homeless youth aren't just housing insecure. Making these investments actually keeps our kids safe from sex trafficking, exploitation, mental health challenges, and other long-term poverty. As we see when we make these investments, we make our future leaders. We see our future professionals sitting right next to us. Again, if you go and you look at the Dr. Foldis study on return on investment, as I mentioned, it talks about the fact that we need to really only get 6 to 7% of youth. He followed a cohort of over 1,000 youth and watched them, that if only 6% of them become successful tax-paying Minnesotans, which I don't remember the threshold, it's like an income per year, that then that helps offset what this cost is. And so it's not much that we have to get out to what we would consider successful, thriving Minnesotans, tax-paying Minnesotans, to be preventative and care. But I want to leave you with a quote that was in this study that the Wilder Foundation, and it's from one of the youth. It's challenging to focus on paperwork when you don't have a safe place to stay, haven't eaten, or are dealing with trauma. It feels particularly true for our youth and young parents. We are just trying to transition to adulthood under such challenging circumstances. What happens to them now and whether or not they can access resources can shape the future of their lives and next generations. I want to remind you that it's not about the dollar amount. It's about the purpose and what we choose to do, and making sure that at any point in time when we have an opportunity to consider any sort of investment, we don't leave our homeless youth out of the conversation. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Vice Chair Keller renews the motion that House File 268 be laid over for possible inclusion. The bill is laid over. The next bill that we have is House File 4725. Representative Norris.
Thank you, Chair Noor, and members of the committee. I think one of the most broadly bipartisan concepts that I hear about is the need to expand access to mental health services in our state. And yet, one of the biggest barriers to achieving that is the lack of mental health workers that we have in our state. And that's because we have a critical workforce shortage of mental health professionals in Minnesota. In fact, 72% of Minnesota counties have been federally designated as mental health provider shortage areas. House File 4725 seeks to address this shortage by creating a mental health and substance use disorder education center. Now, I wish I could claim credit for coming up with this idea, but it was actually our friends at NAMI who brought it to me, and it's actually modeled after a program in Nebraska, which focuses on career awareness and preparation, training, professional support, research, and outreach. Nebraska is the only state in the nation with such a focus on the behavioral health workforce, and they've seen good results. Since the creation of the Workforce Center in Nebraska, the state has seen the number of licensed behavioral health providers grow by 49%. We want to bring this model to Minnesota to offer the support and expertise that we need to have a diverse and robust mental health workforce. Thank you, Chair Noor.
Thank you so much for the introduction, and you have a testifier. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Elliot Butai. I'm the Senior Policy Coordinator at NAMI Minnesota, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. I want to thank you for the opportunity to share today on the proposed Mental Health and Substance Use Disorder Education Center. As Representative Norris mentioned, the idea came to us from Nebraska, which when they created their center in, since they've created their center through the legislature in 2009, their total workforce has increased from 2,200 providers to 3,400 providers, with licensed independent mental health practitioners growing 225%, and psychiatric nurse practitioners growing 168%. And notably, the number of practitioners in rural areas has increased 24%. We know the workforce crisis is a nationwide problem, and when it comes to mental health, the issues and barriers can be complex. It's not as simple as putting more people through school. The workforce needs intentional support from undergrad to the thousands of hours required of supervision, licensing exams, and through financial barriers like paying for supervision or working and learning while raising children. The duties of the Education Center have a few different focuses. One is research. We want the center to analyze the availability of resources and identify gaps. This includes gaps in service areas and gaps for certain demographics seeking services. Another focus is support and training. The center is tasked with promoting and expanding loan forgiveness opportunities, maintaining a resourceful website, establishing learning collaboratives, and developing training for community health workers so that all our healthcare professionals feel more adept at understanding mental illnesses and substance use disorders. The center also focuses on outreach. It's tasked with creating a job board, identifying internships and practicum opportunities, and exposing high school and college students to careers in mental health. Finally, I would say the center is important in helping build a diverse and robust workforce. By identifying barriers and training opportunities, we can address gaps we already know exist, such as services for rural areas and people of color. I can speak professionally, but also personally, to how important it is for providers to understand the culture of the people they serve, and I would say it's essential for healing to take place. We believe this investment would make a deep impact in an area of desperate need. When we build a robust workforce, we increase access to care and increase safety and wellness in our communities. Thank you for considering the bill, and we urge your support.
Thank you so much, Mr. Bhattai. Do we have anyone else in the public who wants to testify on this bill? Seeing none, we now move to member discussion. Representative Hicks.
I just want to say I'm very supportive of this. Greater Minnesota, I'm sure many of the people this around this table know, has a huge shortage of providers, and people wait for a really long time, and then they aren't able to get what they need, and they end up in a crisis and in our emergency rooms, and it just ends up being a circle of frustration for patients, doctors, families, community. Everybody's, you know, sort of gets on this hamster wheel we can't get off of. And so I really appreciate proactive approaches to try to get us off that hamster wheel. So thank you.
Thank you so much. Any other member discussion? Representative Gant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would have to agree this, from even last year when we were meeting, is an unmet need. We have a lot of people who have training in mental health counseling, and we have a lot of people that do substance use disorder counseling, but to bring that together, it's kind of a unique skill set that really is unmet. So I think we had that agreement a year ago as we talked around the table that this kind of provider, this unique provider that can kind of go into both of those lanes at one time, is in great need, and it's an unmet need. So thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other member discussions? Seeing none, to your closing remarks.
Thank you, Chair Noor, and thanks to my colleagues for the positive comments on the bill. I agree. I think this is something that has proven to work in another state, and there's clearly a need here in Minnesota, and so I look forward to working with my colleagues on both sides of the aisle to try to move an idea like this forward. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Representative Norris renews the motion that House File 4725 be laid over. The bill is laid over. Thank you so much to Mr. Bhattai for the testimony and discussion. The next bill will be House File 4637. I'll be going to.
Chair Noor. Chair Noor moves House File 4637 to be laid over for possible inclusion. Chair Noor, to your bill, do you want to move to the DE1?
Yes, Madam Chair. I think this is a technical change. I think this section that was changed with the DE1, if you look at the article and the chapter that was referenced, so we made sure that it was the correct chapter and article as defined. So that was the change that was included in the DE1. Nothing significant change. So I'd like to move the DE1.
Any member discussion to the DE1? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, nay. The motion prevails. The DE1 amendment is adopted. Chair Noor, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. This bill just makes some changes to the reporting requirement for the Metropolitan Center for Independent Living. That was due on the 26th because of the delay of the funding and some other changes that were implemented, and also extends the grant that was dedicated for direct care services called pilot project. So that is the extent of the bill.
Chair Noor, we see you have testifiers with you. Would you like to go to testifiers?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Whichever one wants to go
yes,
first.
Thank you. I'm Jesse
Beth for the
Gomes.
Record and continue.
I'm the Executive Director of Metropolitan Center for Independent Living. Metropolitan Center for Independent Living is one of 8 centers in Minnesota. We're a statutory nonprofit by the Workforce Innovations and Opportunity Act, as well as Minnesota Statute 268A-01, Subdivision 8, Centers for Independent Living. We're thrilled about this program. I had served on the workforce co-cross committee and was one of the technical writers to address the direct care workforce shortage, which is at a crisis. We know there's over 53,000 direct care positions that are opening, and this was one of the projects that we thought in the report that could make a difference. We have been working, you know, assiduously to make this program work. I came from higher education as a former chief strategy officer and vice president of planning and advancements for an urban university, and it has taken countless meetings with higher education to bring forward college students to serve as direct care workers. We're very thrilled and excited of over 20 colleges and universities that are participating, and one of the colleges have also, with the college students who are involved in the direct care workforce program, are providing college credit. So this is a big breakthrough. We are to bring forth a report that will look at how do we go to scale to harness the power of post-secondary institutions in bringing more people into the direct care workforce. And on behalf of the program, I'm so honored to share with you and ask Michelle Varese, who is the Assistant Director of Administration, who oversees the PCA College Service Corps, as referred to it, as is also known as the direct support program. And so Michelle would like to provide testimony. Michelle, please, if you'd introduce yourself.
Please provide Madam your Chair. Name you. And begin with your testimony. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Michelle Varese, and I have the privilege of managing the PCA College Service Corps program on behalf of the Metropolitan Center for Independent Living. We are asking for a time extension of 1 year to utilize funds already allocated to this program to continue this vital work. Matching college students with participants who receive 10 or more hours of services per day creates many invaluable opportunities. Students obtain funding for their studies while gaining valuable work experience and sharpening skills that can be used in many professions. As Jesse said, one school has developed a program whereby students can additionally receive college credit, and many more are on the way. Students have also come to realize that people who receive PCA care at this level are still very active in our communities. As one of those people, I can attest that we are professionals in the workforce, we pay taxes, we contribute. Working also allows us to have access to employer-based health insurance and benefits, lessening the degree of impact on programs like Medicaid. We cannot do these things without PCAs coming in to assist us with activities of daily living. I believe it is the desire of most people to engage in meaningful, impactful work. With this program, college students and program participants are doing that while creating partnerships where everyone can thrive, remaining healthy and productive within community. We are advancing the ability we all have to care for one another. In the home-based care sector, programs like the PCA College Service Corps serve as places where the light gets in to provide hope, services, and truly independent living. Thank you for your time and the opportunity to share the PCA College Service Corps with you.
Thank you. Do we have any other members of the public who wish to testify on this bill? Seeing none, we'll move to member discussion. Do we have any members? Okay, just making sure we give enough time to see if you want to ask anything. Okay, all right. Chair Noor, final comments to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I ask for your support, so thank you so much.
Chair Noor.
Go ahead.
Removes his motion that House File 4637 as amended be laid over. Bill is laid over. Moving on to the next bill on our agenda, 4638.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 4638 addresses one of the significant challenges that we have when it comes to...
Hang on. We got to move the bill in front of us. House File 4368. Chair Norm moves this House File 4368 to be laid over for possible inclusion. The bill is in front of us. Oh, my gosh. My dyslexia is so bad. Okay. Chair Knorr moves House File 4638 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus. Chair Knorr, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, again. This bill addresses one of the significant challenges that we have. I think we started addressing the training and education requirement for the providers, such as the Steps for Success. What this bill does is addresses the need for providers in terms of education efforts for pre-enrollment, post-enrollment training, billing and documentation training, addressing the program integrity, fraud, waste, and abuse, and compliance and legal obligation, among other things that are required. So this is more extended to high-risk programs, ensuring that we are aligned with what the requirements are under the federal rules, also within the same, at the same time, creating guardrails and safeguards to ensure that the programs administered under the high risk, everyone has got information that they need. This is work in progress. We wanted to make sure that the corrective action plan that was required by federal government is included in this section. Likewise, I think there's some few minor technical changes in the bill. We also wanted to address the need for recipient education and training as we move forward. So this puts the folks who are receiving to have the information that they need to make an informed decision. So this is the first section of trying to make sure that we have the necessary tools to ensure that we can extend the Steps for Success, another requirement for any provider before they start providing any services. Likewise, I think the bill also extends the training for any employees and also existing during the revalidation process providers, so that to ensure there's consistency throughout the process. That's the gist of the bill, and we'll be working to make sure that it's extensive and we can provide a proper guidance and requesting a technical assistance from the agency. Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Thank you, Chair. We'll move to our testifiers. We have two testifiers online. First, we'll start with Ms. Farouk. Please identify yourself for the record and begin with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Ania Harut, and I'm the board chair of the Residential Providers Association of Minnesota. I'm here to provide feedback on this bill. Residential Providers Association strongly supports efforts to strengthen provider standards and expand training. We have seen the positive impact of initiatives like Steps for Success, and we believe similar training would benefit additional programs. We also want to emphasize that the training should ultimately be required for all providers, not just those deemed high risk. As current training opportunities are limited, outdated, or in most cases do not exist. We are offering two additional considerations. First, the proposed January 1st, 2027 implementation for both new enrollments and re-enrollments may create capacity challenges as trainings are currently offered on a limited bi-monthly basis, and they require advanced sign up, and those slots fill very quickly. This could be addressed by staggering the implementation dates or ensuring that the trainings are accessible on demand. And secondly, we recommend aligning the training requirement language with existing standards by applying it to individuals with 5% or greater ownership or control interest, and by using the term managing employees to provide clarity and consistency across the board. Thank you for your leadership and thoughtful work on this issue, and thank you to Chair Knorr for your efforts in moving towards a solution.
Thank you, Ms. Harut. We'll move to the second testifier online, Adil Abdul. Please, where are they? Okay. Please identify yourself and begin with your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Adil Abdul. I have a son with autism and have advocated for Minnesota's autism therapy benefit over a decade ago. As you know, this benefit has now been added to the 14 high-risk services. I also think, as the testifier before me has said, actually all of the services should be one of them. I definitely think CTSS should be added, since autism therapy is provided under that benefit as well. Additionally, all Medicaid services, again, should have a proactive compliance training by the Minnesota Department of Human Services for both families and agencies, I'm glad Chair Noor had mentioned the recipients, which are the families. Everybody should understand what the policy is, including their rights and responsibilities. Sadly, DHS and the legislators were not for compliance training when we in the Somali Autism Families asked them years ago, including last year, when Chair of the Senate Human Services added funding for training for families and providers in EIDBI, and then prematurely and wrongly yanked that out. I recommend the legislators ask DHS why they were against compliance training, because we need to be proactive and not reactive, and we need to hold DHS accountable. We are always talking about holding agencies accountable. Yes, very true, but we also need to hold the agency that is in charge of oversight and approvals accountable. I won't say that, and the next thing I was going to say is that the compliance should also include the recipients, but I heard Chair Noor did say that, because it is important to train recipients and providers. Both of us need to know what our rights are and what our responsibilities are. Finally, I do want to just make sure that there is a way for this legislation and all legislations to prohibit from the Department of Human Services from retaliating against not just employees, but families, if in God forbid we disagree with them, because, Madam Chair and members, they have done that and they do still do that. Again, thank you, Chair Noor, for bringing this bill. I appreciate it. And I do hope that all Medicaid providers receive a compliance training as well as Medicaid recipients. Thank you again for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Do we have any members from the public wishing to testify on this bill? We have two. It's a race. Go ahead, identify yourself for the record and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'll be concise, more concise than I typically am. For the record, my name is Josh Berg, and I work for an organization called Accessible Space. I'm on the board of directors for ARM that represents a lot of disability services providers across the state. Just wanted to say that we fully support this bill and the work being done by Chair Noor and then Senator Muhammad and the other body. I did not have a chance to testify in support over there, thinking that this was a no-brainer. And unfortunately, I did not provide, or we did not provide enough support over there, and it's going a somewhat different path now. But hopefully here, this will move smoothly and properly through the process, and again, just want to offer full support and to thank the chair for bringing this forward.
Thank you for that. Please identify yourself for the record and begin.
Hello. Excuse me. I'm Nathaniel M. Olson, the disability advocate for the state of Minnesota. This bill is confusing, but a couple things that I just wanted to make sure that I'm hearing. With everything that's going on, the legislature would be looking at taking some control with the Department of Human Services if people lose their homes. But I live in an ICS home, and it's just crazy of how many violations this place has. And this report was about me. They say vulnerable adults attacked. Literally was called the R word. This was back in 2024. This is the problem that we're having with the Department of Human Services. If they want to say they're coming up here and say they're going to protect people with disabilities, and we are having stuff that are filed late of January 16 of 2025, I mean, I just don't understand. We have this bill right before us, and it's just very confusing because we're getting nowhere right now. We're literally seeing a lot of issues that are happening. I'm seeing a lot of issues with the Department of Human Services. I'm seeing a lot of issues in my own home. So my question is, how are we going to figure out a plan to solve this? We're getting too many legislation bills getting forward. I don't believe this bill is going to help. I believe we need to figure out a different way to get this plant out. Are you able to answer that question, or?
Chair Noor, did you want to answer the question?
I think that it was more of a commentary. The bill addresses the need for having provider training and education, particularly in high risk, so that there's a compliance, there's an understanding of their duties to provide services, to understand how to apply the, if there's any inconsistency, if there are any instances of fraud and abuse and waste, so that they understand how the system is supposed to be done correctly, including the billing, so that they understand before they start billing how much, you know, should they bill for a service? What is the authorized? What is the legal pathway? Because you may provide services in an ICS for a couple of hours, but because it's a daily rate, what does that really mean? When somebody refuses to get services, what does that really mean? So all those things have to be put in training, and that training must be mandatory for all providers so that they have that responsibility and they also have a guidance that they can follow.
Thank you, Chair Noor. Thank you for your testimony. We'll move to member. Is there anybody else from the public who wishes to testify?
Thank you.
Seeing none, we'll move to member discussion. We have Vice Chair Gilman.
Thank you, Chair. And I had just a couple questions in regards to the oversight and just discretion around compliance training. So would DHS, you know, come up with the content, come up with things, or do they sub out and hire vendors to help them do? Basically, I'm thinking of it like continuing education, like when I was a dental assistant back in the day. And so we had, you know, X amount of, you know, continuing that every single year to kind of keep us dialed in with what's happening. So do they hire out vendors that do this, or does DHS have a group of folks that work for them that come up with this content? That's my question.
Chair Noor.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. That's a good question because I've been asking for provider relations somehow to have a team that is fully responsible for ensuring the training education for the providers. So technically based on the steps for success, there are vendors who are also delivering the steps for success. The agency is also providing similar process, but there's also webinars and other tools that the agency uses for training purpose. But this will ensure that every provider has good access to that training, and they can be able to log back in and see what the training was. So this puts the agency in control of what is provided, regardless of whether it's done through a vendor or it's done through DHS.
Thank you, Chair. So follow up with that. Could there be a way that we could, you know, tighten that up so we would know in the bill, for example, I've spoke with a vendor, and they identified just with patterns of who was, you know, using their content to, you know, support new providers that were coming online, and they could see, you know, where their offices were, you know, things that were happening, and things just seemed very much like a pattern. And so it was waste, fraud, and abuse that was happening. Great content. They're taking our, you know, what we're putting into statute here through MDH, DHS, and they're providing the services, but they could see patterns. So they were able to, you know, go on that. I just want to make sure that we would not be creating more. It'd be great to have clarity to know, are they contracting this out? And then would those vendors have an obligation as they see? Because I did sit with them and they could see a pattern of things happening, and it's interesting that these things were happening over and over again every single month. They would get the information from them, and they would pay for a few months for this training and this, you know, continuing education and certification or whatever you want to call it, not certification, but this content, and then they would fall off. But it was the same thing happening over and over again. So I would love to see where that we could put something in here that there would be an accountability or reporting so we could see what's happening, because I think that was a really interesting concept on the training piece of it.
Chair Noor.
Thank you so much. I think that should be part of the provider enrollment. So the pre-enrollment process and also ongoing through the post-enrollment, as we have already established some framework under the bill that we passed from Representative Hicks. So this will be supplemental to that to ensure that there's a understanding and also getting the report back on who's getting the training, who's being dropped, and what are the circumstances so we can keep on tightening the belt and ensure that we put suspenders to ensure that we have enough information going forward.
Vice Chair Gilman?
I like it. I like suspenders and belts. I think that's whatever we can do to shore things up. That'd be great. Thank you.
Representative Curran?
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Chair Knorr. And I appreciate the concerns brought up by Vice Chair Gilman, because I think folks who are in the space of training people and have might show up because this place is required to do it, so they're having somebody come train, and then the trainer says, oh my gosh, you guys are fraudsters, right? Like, we need to be able to do something about that. So I appreciate that input. And I will just say, too, that for some of the larger providers who have enough resources, they might already have a quality assurance department or a compliance department where they've got one to a few staff who are dedicated to ensure that that provider is doing everything correctly, not just financially, but also under all of the other standards that that are required under statute. So this really is something that's extremely helpful to those smaller providers who end up calling the larger providers to say, this is how we're doing it, we wanna do it right. But this is so confusing, we never got trained, how do we make sure we do this in a legal way? Is this how we're supposed to be doing it? So I think this actually is really, really helpful for the folks who don't have the current resources. I will say that this kind of training can happen for free, and that could happen for free in partnership with providers who are already sort of doing their own internal training. There are groups of providers who already get together on a regular basis to go over things that they all have in common, changes that affect all of them at the same time. I think we could find a way to work that in where a group of providers get into a room together and have a presentation, and they have representatives from each of their providers, and now each provider is covered under that training. I think there's opportunities where we could do that, where it wouldn't cost necessarily cost providers much money to get this training.
Did you want to Chair Knorr, anything to that?
No, I think that's a good point to consider.
Well, Representative Gander.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I don't believe that this is particularly onerous at all. Probably you know, as Medicare providers, as an optometrist Medicare provider, we had to do fraud, waste, and abuse training every single year as providers. We take our staff through that every year. It takes about an hour. And it's a really great time, I think, even for the owner of the practice to say, this is who we are. This is what we stand for. If anything along the way, and I think sometimes it could even happen unintentionally, that some practice got like baked into how you did your practice, and it was just not right. So you would tell your whole team, if there's anything you see ever that does not pass your smell test, we want to know about it. We want to correct it. We want to fix it. So, and we had to do it again at every time of renewal of our standing with Medicare. And I can say that present tense because I'll be back there tomorrow. So I think this is a good move. And I think the other thing it does is nobody could deny that they knew this. Right? If somebody did something fraudulent, if they did something wasteful or abusive, you couldn't say, wow, gee, I didn't know. No, you've been through the training, and here's the curriculum for the training, and now we can hold you more accountable because we know you've been trained like that. So I think this is a very good thing. And to the testifier who said, you know, maybe all providers and even participants should have some training like this, I think that would be worthwhile to consider as well. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Rep Hicks?
So here's, thank you for this bill. Here's what I love about this bill, is not everybody should be a provider. Unpopular statement. Not everybody should start a business in human services. You just shouldn't. I have said this before, and so I hate teeth, and I should not be a dentist. I'm not a dentist, and I hate teeth. I should not enroll to be a dentist. I shouldn't open a dental provider. I shouldn't employ dentist and dental hygienist. I hate teeth. Right? Not everybody should be in human services. And what this bill does is before you get enrolled, before you're able to jump into the ship, someone tells you what the job really is and what you actually have to do and how you cross the T's and dot the I's before you enroll, which is what we should always have been doing. So thank you.
Anybody else? None? Chair Norr, final comments to your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I think this is a good bill. We will work with the agency and the stakeholders to improve the language, and hopefully we can include it in our bill. So I renew my motion that House File 4638 to be laid over.
The bill is laid over. With that, we will be back on Tuesday. We get to be back at 8:15 on Tuesday. With that, we are adjourned.